Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation. Since the date of recording, Dr. Mahar has accepted a new position as Assistant Professor of Health Justice and Bioethics with the Lewis Katz School of Medicine at Temple University.
Welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins, and we're really excited to have my friend and dear colleague, Dr. Karen Mahar, here today. Karen is an assistant professor and associate director of public engagement in the biomedical ethics research program at Mayo Clinic, and her research interests focus on public health ethics and social implications of advances in microbial and human genetics. From 2016 to 2017, she completed a postdoctoral research fellowship in qualitative research methods in the Department of Social Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine. From 2012 to 2016, she worked as a senior policy and research analyst on the staff of President Barack Obama's Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues. She has a PhD in philosophy from Michigan State University and a bachelor's degree from Hamilton College. So you're really welcome to Bioethics in the Margins, and really glad that we could have you here today.
Ah, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So give us a little bit of a description of your journey to becoming a bioethicist. You've done some really interesting things on your journey. Love to hear about that.
Yeah, sure. So first, the views here are my own and not anybody that I'm affiliated with. But I came to bioethics, I think, probably in the same way I think a lot of us are drawn to a lot of different ways of learning about the world. Kind of maybe a natural humanities person at heart. I think one of the things that's really interesting is when I was really young, I was in high school, and I had a friend whose mother was a community college professor. And I think those examples are so important. I think there's really great evidence to show that when it's normal for you to have those instances in your life, it opens up this idea that that might be a possibility for you. And I had a ton of teachers in my life. My mom was an elementary school teacher, and obviously you go through school, so I really liked learning, but I think it had never occurred to me until I learned about his mom that you could teach at that higher level. You know, it just opened up this door in my mind. And so when I went to undergrad, I did a very liberal arts degree at Hamilton College. And I could tell at that time that I wanted to do more education, but I didn't really know what. But I was taking these philosophy classes at the time, and I was especially focused on philosophy of science, sort of the social influences on how science gets done. And I wanted to explore that a little bit more. So then I went to graduate school at Michigan State in a philosophy program, but it was a philosophy program that was created for people like me. I was really a science major in undergrad. And so it didn't have this expectation that you'd sort of done the classics in the way that philosophers often do. And it had a real strength in ethics, applied ethics in particular, and bioethics. And that's kind of where my path took me. And my dissertation was on public health ethics. I was really interested in how ethics developed as a field around medicine and at the bedside, which is not a place philosophers are usually invited. So I was really interested in how we might get into other spaces and serve other health professions. So that's why I wrote my dissertation on a virtue approach to public health ethics, which is a moral theory that's more oriented around who do we want to be, questions of who do we want to be and how we are called to be a certain kind of way in the world, in contrast to other moral theories, which are really about like, what should we do, those classic ethic questions. And yeah, so then I went on and I did health science and technology policy So we can talk about that experience working for the Bioethics Commission at the federal level. And then I could tell at that point that if I wanted to continue, especially in academic medicine, I was going to need an empirical skill set. So that's why I did a postdoc in qualitative research methods. And then I ended up at Mayo Clinic, and I don't know what's next. We'll see.
So tell us maybe a little more about the commission. What was the most interesting thing that you worked on there and the thing that you think has had the most implications going forward?
Ooh, that's such a good question. What I think has the biggest implications might not be what other people think. So just a crash course for listeners who might not be familiar with how federal advisory committees work, that they are advisory bodies to the executive branch. So presidents, but also anybody working for that administration, that level, they can be assembled for all different kinds of reasons. And they often are assembled, you know, in the moment, like in response to something. And so traditionally, there have been bioethics commissions for at the federal level for a variety of reasons ever since the National Commission is its shorthand term, which is what led to protections for human subjects in research. But federal advisory committees, they have to meet quarterly. They can meet more frequently, but by law, they have to meet quarterly. And they're composed of different members who have certain kinds of expertise or perspectives that they bring to bear. The staff of those commissions works full time. So I was on the staff, and it can be a lot less glamorous than it sounds. So I spent most of my time for 4 years in a basement with no windows, the way many staffers in DC do. But my job is essentially to help interpret any of the philosophical expertise of the commission members who are meeting in public. They meet, that's a requirement of federal advisory committees, is that they meet publicly. And then they are advisory. So there are different ways that they can be structured. But oftentimes they release a bunch of recommendations to the executive branch, but they can actually direct those recommendations anywhere. So they can say, this is what Congress should do, or this is what the states should do. Whether or not anybody listens is sort of up to them. And they also, especially at the bioethics level, might articulate some things at the level of professional responsibility. So they might say, if they're working on, say, a cardiac issue, they might say, hey, cardiologist, this is an area where you could advance best practices. So a lot of the issues that I worked on when I was there were issues around genetics and privacy, return of results, and incidental findings. So you go looking for one thing, but you find another thing, which happens a lot in research. And we worked on ethics and the Ebola virus disease outbreak in 2014 to 2016. And we also worked on things like ethics and democratic deliberation, which is a way of making decisions. And specifically, we looked at how that overlaps with issues in education. So that was, it was really kind of exciting because you got to work on so many different things. But one of the things that I think is really important is in one of the reports that we did on incidental findings, we made the decision, I think the commission made the decision that they should address direct-to-consumer healthcare. Because there are different groups that are offering different kinds of tests direct, right? You don't have to go through a doctor, and that can be challenging for a variety of reasons. And I think it's easy to forget when you aren't part of a group like that, that every group after is going to look back in order to figure out what the legitimate scope is of a body that gives that kind of advice. And by deciding that bioethics had a role in asking these questions in the commercial sector, I think we really opened the door for future bodies to do the same, to say, how are we thinking about commercial activity in relationship to health? And that is a huge domain that I think there's great opportunity for in bioethics.
Wonderful. And yeah, I should mention that Nicole Strand, who is part of our team, I think you met her during your time on the commission.
Yeah.
And we also have had Dr. Allen, who worked on the commission, on our podcast. So thank you.
Yes, I listened to her episode on privacy. High recommendation for those listening.
Thank you. Brilliant. So now I just kind of want to ask you about how you got into sort of public health ethics from there. or from your, the start, you said your dissertation was related to public health ethics. So what was it that drew you to that particular field?
I think there's a kind of inherent normative aspect to public health ethics. So in philosophy, by normative, we mean questions of ought and should. And I think that there's a commitment in public health to care for everyone. And that's the inherent way of thinking about people as a population and committing to take care of an entire group. Whether that's, you know, you're a community health worker and that's your county, or whether that's your city, I think there's something inherent in that that's a little bit distinct from being a clinician who, any patient that walks in your door, that's where your obligations lie. There's, I think, something quite distinct to saying, it doesn't matter if this person even knows me, I'm obligated to them to serve their health because they're part of my community. And dedicating your life to that kind of work, I think, is, and it, I thought it was interesting to me, like, there's not a companion set of ethical discourse dedicated, in part because bioethics is so new as a field, there hasn't really been a dedicated ethics literature in health. Those questions have always been with the health professions, but there hasn't been an academic discipline dedicated to sort of travel alongside those professionals. And bioethics as a discourse really started in conjunction with medicine and the patients' rights movement. So I think asking the question, what would it look like if it was more in conversation with those who've dedicated their life to the work that's really a public health service? You know, it's about what government does to advance the health of everyone. I think that's a really different set of questions, and I was really drawn to it. And part of it was, you know, sometimes when you're very young and like trying to figure out what it means to be a scholar and you're figuring things out, I think you're able to see things that people who've been around for a long time in a field can't see because they've just been in it for so long, and you get kind of in your own echo chamber about what even is a legitimate question in the field. And bioethics really was mostly focused on issues at the bedside and in research ethics at the time, for a variety of reasons, including research ethics violations. But I think I could see, like, there were just kind of hints. There were a few books that were really making it big in the early 2000s that were about public health ethics, and the journal specifically dedicated to public health ethics launched in, I think, 2006. And so I think at that time, I was really seeing that there was this tiny, tiny subspecialty that was coming up. And I was really interested in sort of how it was different and who, and really who it wanted to be in conversation with.
And just one more question before I hand it over to Kirk. I'd love to ask about your role as Associate Director of Public Engagement. Can you kind of tell us what activities you led with that, and what did you see as the benefits of doing that and engaging the public?
Oh, such a great question. So I think I sunsetted that role a couple years ago, but I spent quite a bit of my time as a first-time faculty member at Mayo Clinic working really, like, very much in what I think ethicists call, like, embedded research, or just part of a team. It super integrated into the Mayo Clinic biobank. And there was an ethicist who was here prior to me, Barbara Koenig, who had started work with the Mayo Clinic Biobank to just start talking to the community about what a biobank was. And, you know, biobanks create these big questions that are ethically important because you give your blood, you give your sample, and you give your information, all of your health information. And all of that is disconnected from your name and anything that could tell anybody who you are, but it is still yours. Still about you. And it's also about your family, right? Because if they're going to look at your blood, they could look at your genetics. So that means it could be about people who don't decide to join or donate to a biobank. And one of the big challenges of biobanks is that you can say, oh, I would love to support future research, but nobody knows what the future is going to hold. And so that creates this conundrum in sort of how we think about the ethics of research, where you give informed and voluntary consent to how you participate in a research study. And because you can't predict the future, you're sort of in this situation where you can ask the question, like, is someone really informed when they say, sure, use this. I support research vaguely for forever. And so a lot of what I did as associate director was direct community engagement activities, both in Rochester, Minnesota, and also in Jacksonville, Florida, where there is another biobank location. We also had partners in Phoenix, Arizona, who have a separate biobank there called Sangre por Salud, in conjunction with a federally qualified healthcare center there, Mountain Park Healthcare Center, and they serve a primarily Hispanic community down there. And so it was really fun to see how different communities thought about their contributions. And really the effort of community engagement was to try and give the leaders of Mayo Clinic Biobank and the biobank down there, SPS, more information about how to conduct the research into the future and ongoing with new projects, with community input, so that it wasn't just a one-time sign-off, that it was constantly kind of using the community voices as a touchstone for making decisions about how research moves forward and what research moves forward. And I learned a lot in the process about how communities work and how community members can make science better. And it's really important to emphasize, like, we hear a lot about community-engaged research, and oftentimes what people are talking about is more on the community-based participatory research model, which is often abbreviated CBPR for those of us in bioethics. They might be more familiar with that approach. And that's often very much focused on clinical trials. But a lot of what I did, the people who are scientists using biobanks are basic scientists. They often are exclusively using large data sets to ask questions that are very early. They are not in a space that's going to become the next big drug tomorrow. It's going to be a very long haul if it ever gets there. And so it's a very different set of scientists to work with, because they are much less familiar with community engaged approaches. And so there's both, I think, an important aspect of that work that's working with communities, but also a really important kind of thing that bioethicists uniquely get to do, where you get to interact with scientists in a way that you see what makes them tick, and you learn a lot about how to be a bridge between those two different worlds.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. Thank you for that background. Really interesting where different particular contexts provide more insight about, oh, I didn't know, who knew about, biobanks. And of course, the deep importance of biobanks is, as you mentioned, is very important, but something that is not really talked about in a general bioethical setting. So thank you so much for sharing your insights on that. My question, and I'm assuming this is connected to the overuse of antibiotics, right? That are in our food and the water supply, but also prescription, right? What we use when we have some type of infection. I know that your field focuses on antimicrobial resistance. Can you please expound on that for us?
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much for asking, because this is an area, I mean, researchers are so funny. We get so geeked out about, like, these very, like, are the issues that we're like make us tick, or like just make us want to keep asking questions. But just to, for the audience that's listening, to make the bridge, I think sometimes it's really challenging to say, oh, how did she get from biobankings to antimicrobial resistance? And part of it is that, so there's a subset of bioethics that is called ethical, legal, and social implications of genetics. And this is a set of research that has largely funded by NIH, and it was funded in part to go alongside the Human Genome Project. So just as sort of the advent, especially in the 1980s, of genetic sequencing came about, there were all these questions. How do we avoid recapitulating the history of eugenics? What is it going to mean to people to learn about these genetic findings, both in terms of their ancestry, but also in terms of risk for diseases? And what does it mean to have that information when you don't really know what the future looks like? And how do we decide, especially, both as scientists, but also for clinicians, like, when is the right point to tell people that information so that they can do something with it, and who decides, right? Because clinicians might answer that question differently than patients. And one of the things that's always been interesting to me is that we treat human genetic information very differently than we treat information that's genetic about any other organism. So if you have an infection, and you know, we all saw this during COVID, you go and you get a swab and you find out, you know, you have a COVID infection. Sometimes the way you're finding out is you're getting a genetic sequence of the viruses that are in you, and they look for COVID in particular, and it tells you. And part of the reason they're looking genetically is they want to know, right? We all heard Omicron versus Alpha, like all these different strains, and they want to know which strain you have, partly because that can change the clinical course, like your symptom severity, but partly because that's a population health issue, right? Like which strains are dominating in a community can be very important information to have about controlling the spread of it. But we don't really have an entire area of scholarship dedicated to the advances that we've seen in the same time period in genetics for pathogens or microbes, the organisms that live within us. And so that kind of disparity to me, that kind of disconnect between why we're investing all of this social science in one area of genetics but not in another was really fascinating to me. And it's partly what got me interested in resistant infections. You can end up with a bug, as they say, they talk about it as bugs and drugs. You can end up with a microorganism that doesn't respond to medications or only responds to very specific medications. And that creates a conundrum for patients and for providers about how to decide what course of treatment to give and when to give it and how to avoid, in particular, resistance can increase over time. And the way that it increases is if people are exposed to antibiotics. So it creates a real conundrum collectively for all of us, because the more that you give in antibiotics, which people need to treat infections, the faster resistance develops for your society. And then the question is, like, those drugs don't work anymore, right? If the organisms are resistant to those medicines, you need a different medicine. So you end up with this kind of treadmill in which you're chasing the next drug. Or you're asking the question, when do we not use this? Because collectively we have this interest in not using it. But our system, right, is often, especially ethically, not designed to kind of weigh those tensions of like this individual and this collective need. And so that's what drew me to those questions. And there's a host of them. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'm curious, I do have two follow-up questions behind what you just said. The first, how you are connected with this particular project. We all know, of course, under former President Bill Clinton's presidency, helped launch the Human Genome Project, right, which ended in early 2000s. And I know that at the beginning of former President Barack Obama's presidency, there was the Human Microbiome Project. I believe it started in 2007 by the National Institutes of Health. To your knowledge, and of course, if you're not well-versed in that, that's fine. But I'm just curious, have you come across in your experience anything connected with the microbiome and antimicrobial resistance? That just popped up. I was like, I don't know if you came across anything of that nature in your research.
Yeah, so a lot of, especially the ethics literature that came with the microbiome project is really fascinating. They addressed a variety of issues, but a lot of it is not necessarily about resistance, in part because at that time, during that era, there was a lot of research that was coming out about how to improve people's, what we call like normal flora, the kind of bugs and drugs that hang out in our gut and are really helping us. And so that's exciting because, right, it's like symbiosis. They're hanging out down there doing what they need to do. And we're benefiting at the same time as they get an environment in which to live. But a lot of people's microbiomes can get disrupted. And so the really kind of cutting edge advances in clinical care at the time were about trying to help people restore their microbiome or like return those normal flora. And so that was where more of the ethics literature was focused. Right now, the newest NIH initiative is called the Human Virome Project. And it's specifically dedicated to, it's kind of like the microbiome, right? It's like viruses are a subset of the organisms that live within us. But it's specifically focused on viruses because some of the viruses within us don't do anything, right? They maybe were in symbiosis, maybe they're latent and they're inactive and they can become active, right? They can become infections if they, you know, we hear about that with meningitis. It's in you, but then it turns on somehow. And then, sorry, I'm obviously not a virologist. All different kinds of things like that. So it's really dedicated to trying and understanding all the viruses that live within us. And there is an interesting kind of dynamic there too, because there are viruses that are called bacteriophages. And bacteriophages, actually, their function is the way that they survive is off of other bacteria. So they're viruses that their host or what they infect is bacteria, which again can end up being sort of an advantage to humans, because if you have a harmful bacteria and you have a bacteriophage in you that sees it as its natural competitor or way of surviving, then you can actually benefit from having that bacteriophage within you. But we really don't understand the full landscape of all of these viruses that live within us all day. And so that project is dedicated to trying to even just understand all the different viruses that are within us. And they do have ethical, legal, and social implications, what are called ELSI cores, that are go alongside each of those projects. And part of that is because it's tricky to get all of the samples from people. So it actually kind of goes back to those questions about biobanking. Because if you're going to gather, you're trying, right, scientifically to understand all of this one set of information about the human body, but you're inevitably going to uncover other things about the human body and trying to get all those samples and trying to put that picture together. And so it's, again, really challenging to communicate to people who may be very interested in supporting that research, but may not realize like there are all of these other aspects to it that are hard to predict at the moment.
No, thank you. I'm a huge geek on the microbiome. This was a perfect opportunity for me to ask you that question, because it's just a whole nother world that we're still trying to uncover. And I was like, this was the right opportunity to ask someone who's familiar. So thank you for entertaining that question. My other follow-up question that you said was really interesting, and this is my area of expertise, is eugenics and the understanding of eugenics and how, fortunately and unfortunately, history repeats itself. And when you mention that particular comment, of course, it reminded me of the infamous incident of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson, of course, his soul rest in peace. And of course, the person who shot him and killed him in New York City, Luigi Mangione. And the perspective of healthcare and health insurance overall, and of course, the negative dynamic society has perception society has regarding health insurance, regarding denying claims and literally life and death situations. And unfortunately, the claims took so long that unfortunately the person, you know, passed away in the process of waiting to get this life-saving treatment. And the reason why I bring that up is because, of course, eugenics also brings these negative, you know, misogynistic, racial connotations that, you know, God forbid we dare to repeat, but it just reminds me of the more genetic information we have that is accessible, for example, to insurance companies. My fear, and I'd like to hear your comment on that, my fear is that we're repeating the same like negative perceptions and labels on individuals based off of genetic information that is out of their control. Your genetics is your genetics, right? You have the good and the bad from your mother and your father. So I'm hoping that it won't continue to create discriminatory practices, you know, prejudices for a person that has a particular gene, no fault of their own. Of course, you don't choose your genes, but then are mistreated in a particular way that causes, you know, malfeasance, right? So I guess that's more of a comment rather than a question, but if you have a particular response to just my thoughts of just hearing you talk about your experiences in that, you know, that would also be interesting as well.
Yeah, so we've seen this in human genetics in particular, to ask these questions and the struggle with using demographic descriptors, especially in genetics, is challenging in part because we have this tendency, right? If you go to an ancestry company, they're going to tell you, like, they give you information, but it's almost always geographically defined. And there's really great scholarship on how the geography can be very misleading, right? If it tells you, like, for me, it's going to tell me, like, I'm whatever percent European, like 100%. So pale for the non-listeners, and especially, right, Irish. But those markers, it's really important for us, I think, to constantly reframe. Like, we all come out of Africa evolutionarily, and those geography markers are contemporary, right? We have to be very careful. Those are human-created boundaries drawn on a map, often in the context of colonialism, and we're imposing them on biology, which does very much recapitulate some of what we saw in eugenics, that sort of the body itself tells us who we are and that we're different from one another in a way that I think is quite misleading. And what I always say about that kind of information is that it should always come with a time period. How long ago did your ancestors live in that area? Like, when did that happen? Because, of course, you can be out of Africa like all of us, and also you can have ancestry that comes out of Ireland because they're different time periods and your ancestors moved, migrated. And it opens up a conversation too, right, that overlaps with migration. And I think that's a really important one because it's especially relevant, like, as we switch from thinking about the eugenic possibilities and human genetics, and we shift to microbial genetics, and we start thinking about pathogens, it's really important for us to notice that especially the figurative language that we use to try and even talk about how organisms live within us, right? We talk about immunity, we start to talk about self and other, right? My immune system recognizes a quote unquote foreign body and then activates and defends itself, right? And so already we end up in a kind of antagonistic way of talking. And, like, inevitably that conjures up the same discourse that we have about migration and our relationship as a civic body to immigrants, right? And then the body becomes a sort of metaphor for policing itself against invading pathogens. And so we have to be really careful, I think. And that's one of the reasons that I'm really interested in antimicrobial resistance, is sort of how those ways of talking about immunity actually change over time socially. We don't talk about the body in the same way in every culture. And the body becomes an area for us to kind of blend, right, these ways of thinking about both our relationship to the microbes within us, but also our relationship to each other. And so being very clear about when we're kind of eliding that, like, you can even see it in the media coverage around resistant pathogens. And so, and there's kind of a fun thing too in there, like more levity. I'll add a little bit of that in, right? Resistant infections kind of go along this other line, right? Because we call them superbugs, and we are always kind of interested in the next best drug to treat them. And those are called super drugs. And the way that that's often communicated to the public, right, is like they're wearing capes. And so there's also this element there of, like, it kind of the marvelization of the microbial world. But also just sort of, like, I think we forget sometimes that that is actually appealing to a very important era of the 1950s, in which antibiotics became increasingly available to some people and not others, as the Tuskegee public health experiments show. And I think it's really important for us to think about how historically we understand antibiotics to have been often what was called, like, a miracle cure. And it's important for us to think about how that has the cultural echo to it, but to be critically reflective on how some of that's the case, right? Like, we all would like to have, if we have an infection, we would really like to have them, but they actually do have terrible side effects, right? That they aren't, oftentimes people think of, like, oh, you just take an antibiotic and you're done and you just go on with your life, which is true. And it's great, especially for childhood infections. But at the same time, they do have risks that attend exposure. And I think a little bit more of a nuanced conversation publicly. And, you know, it's why we need historians alongside ethicists to ask these questions.
Absolutely. And yeah, again, it's such a huge field. For example, you know, the agribusiness model, because of the soil that we are eating, the soil is not as nutrient, so therefore we're not getting the proper microbes in our gut. You know, my nutritionist tells us all the time, right? You gotta change this model. And of course, even with newborn babies, I was just reading an article a couple of days ago. Can't remember off the top of my head, so I don't want to give you the wrong article, but how newborn babies now, their microbiome is at a deficiency because of course, many different factors, including that, but also mother and maternal health. It's just a huge, fascinating field. But I'll digress because I don't want to dive right back into that. So one last question before I give it back to Amelia. For our listeners, Dr. Mahar wrote a wonderful piece in the American Medical Association Journal of Ethics. It's February 2024 edition, specifically volume 26, number 2, E162-170, just to give you the exact article for you to check it out. But the title is, Can One Health Policy Help Us Expand an Ethics of Interconnection and Interdependence? Which is also a fascinating title as well. And also want to mention that you also are article amongst many other peer-reviewed articles as well. And you could go on our website and check Dr. Mahar out. She will have a list of the different articles that she has published as well. But can you expound a little bit about what that article is about, the purpose, the intentionality on, and the importance, of course, on that article?
Yeah, so thank you for talking about this and actually, you know, mentioning that about the food that we eat, because it does, it's a perfect kind of bridge over to what I started working on for this piece, which is really One Health Policy. And One Health Policy is really a call to understand that, yeah, we actually spend a tremendous amount of effort in the medical sector trying to ask this question, like when is it even beneficial to give this antibiotic to the patient? Because there are these side effects, and we all sort of collectively forget that there are side effects that go along with antibiotics. And then, but you know, there are these other areas, these sectors, especially agriculture, where antibiotics are incredibly used at high volume, especially in the United States. And another area is veterinary health, right? People get antibiotic prescriptions for, like, I have a puppy, he's great, all the time, right? They get infections too. And so if you're only trying to think about resistance, like preventing, and another way of thinking about the efforts to steward antibiotics is as conservation, right? We want these medicines to work for generations and generations and generations. So when every choice that you make about using them is a choice about whoever is in front of you, the dog, the flock of chickens, the patient. It's also about the next generation and whether or not they'll have that tool at their disposal. And so One Health is really about trying to make sure that when we adjust one area of policy, we're not only looking at the impact on humans, we're really looking at impact on the microbiome. We're looking at the impact on the environment. We're considering the impact on veterinary practice so that we're not only sort of hyper-focused on one aspect. And that's very challenging to do, both from a scientific perspective, but also from a policy perspective, because we're quite used to making policy that kind of only focuses on one thing at a time. And it coordinates is really a huge part of what we're talking about.
Yeah, I love the way you draw attention to this, because most of us do think of this issue as being at the sort of patient level in the hospital or attending a clinic. So you describe two concepts, interconnection, well, the ethics of interconnection, interdependence. So can you explain those? And they're slightly different, I think. So can you explain those to us?
Yeah, I try and think of interconnectedness as really kind of more causal in a way. And I distinguish three different types of interconnection. And if we really focus on causal factors, one way of thinking about interconnection is epistemic. And right, as researchers, we are so siloed from one another. And the causes that we're interested in, right, if you're interested in patients, you might be trying to figure out what's making them either complete their course of antibiotics or, oops, I just put that in my closet and forgot about it once I was feeling better, right? So like that's just a simple research question that you might ask only within medicine. But really, if you're trying to broaden the way that science even works, You want to be inviting other forms and other disciplines into that conversation about which causes matter and why they matter. And so really a lot of One Health science is really about trying to expand the way that different fields interact with each other so that you can have a social scientist talking to someone who's looking at these issues within the hospital. So that you can have someone who is a veterinary scientist who is also asking those questions. And you're actually talking to each other and you're not writing in totally different journals. You're not going to totally different conferences. And so you aren't missing huge features of what other people have discovered. And you're really trying to be more in conversation about just even what we know about microorganisms and the medicines that we have and how they have interactions that you might not even be paying attention to because that's not how you were trained. And another area is of interconnection is more practical, right? And that's the point about policy that I made. Like if you just try and fix one area of policy, you were totally ignoring this other area of policy. And people have realized, especially at the international level, the global level, the WHO has something called the quadripartite. Just a huge name, but it's trying to bring in all of these entities, veterinary, environmental, human, agricultural, to try and make sure that the policies recommendations that are happening in one sector are aligned with the policy recommendations that are happening in another. And one reason that you really want to do that is when you're making policy, you want buy-in from the people who have to do the things that you're recommending. And one thing that has been really interesting is that like if you want agriculture policy to change regarding antimicrobial use, the best way to get that is to have the farmers be advocating for it themselves because they understand the importance of having these tools for generations. And that's what they do, right? These are people who are caring about the health of their flocks and their herds for generations. And so to get them on board and sort of have them even advocating for these changes themselves is a huge advantage. And if especially what you're doing is anything close to what we do in ethics, where it's like, please do this thing, it's best practice, you need that buy-in to have the motivation to abide by recommendations. And then lastly, there's this aspect of interconnectedness that I really want. And this is where I think like this is sort of my first foray into One Health ethics. But I really want to think about this a lot more because we have so much trouble talking about how we benefit from shared things. So like the easiest examples are like clean water and clean air. Like if I walk outside and I can breathe the air because it's clean, you can too. That's a collective benefit. And that is something that's causal, right? But we want to talk about it as a good. And risk and benefit kind of work in this same way. So one of the things that's really hard to talk about from antimicrobial resistance is like it's a benefit that results from an absence, right? There are fewer resistant bugs in your environment, you can't be infected by them. But that collective absence, that benefit of something that's not present, it's kind of like not having toxicity in the air, right? It's hard to talk about like, oh, my air is clean is something we talk about. But we don't talk about having like clean biome, right? So having bacteria that are responsive to antibiotics is a huge advantage at the collective level. It's something that we share. It's not something that I can get and you can't get. It's because of the microbes that are all around all of us. So it's something that is only accessible to us as a collective kind of aspect of our lived environment. And so, which, you know, I think Kirk goes to your point, right? Why does that newborn not have as diverse of a microbiome when it's born? It has to do with mom, right? And all of the microbiome that's all around all of us and how it can become less and less diverse over time, depending on the way humans live now in comparison to how they used to live. And so these are things that are difficult, I think, ethically to put our finger on, even though they're very scientific in nature, this notion of something that you can't kind of quantify aggregately, but you have to characterize it as something that is the result of causation, but it applies to everybody in a group. And then if you want, I'll talk about interdependence. Okay, good. So interdependence, I just define it here a little bit more normatively, but again, it can be descriptive, right? And this is part of the problem. This is sort of like why it's kind of a classic Socratic issue, right? Socrates would go and say like, oh, you think that let's say knowledge is really important. What is knowledge? Tell me what you think that is. And then it would turn out like, oh, I use this word all the time, but I actually have no idea what I mean by it. That's something that happens with interconnectedness and interdependence. Like, we can use those words all the time, but not realize that we don't actually know what we mean by them or even have a shared definition of it. But I think of interdependence, like I take that, like think about depend. What does it mean to depend on something? It just means counting on it. And that could be a factual relationship, right? Like you can count, like something might rely on something in a causal way. So if I'm trying to come up with a really good example. So supply chains are a really great example, right? So if I'm relying on this ingredient that I need to make my product, but it's like made three different steps down the supply chain, I'm relying on someone else who's making it, but it won't get to me if their situation ends up getting disrupted for various reasons. And then I can't sell my product and my business collapses, right? So that's interdependence, but it might just be sort of a factual relationship. It becomes normative when we start to realize that those dependencies require us to do different things, right? It becomes questions of, okay, well, if we want to be able to count on that, if we want to shore up that reliability, what should we do? What ought we to do? Those moral questions come when we recognize that the counting matters to us and we want to shore it up. We want to make that more reliable, that dependency, something that, and then it creates a sort of questions about our moral obligations. And that same thing happens when you realize like my health counts on yours because we share the same microbiotic environment. So the more that I count on you and you count on me to have different kinds of microbiotic relationships, or we realize we can only get those things if we act together, now all of a sudden we have a collective action problem. How do we get those things together? And that brings us straight back to public health, right? Their obligation is to help all of us, not the patient that just walks in the door, but every single person that's part of the community. And so to me, that's really kind of what drew me to those questions of what does it mean to depend on people. And, you know, those relationships can be very thin, but they can be the thickest ones that we have, like that infant that you mentioned, right? That's going to be the deepest kind of dependence that there is taking care of a being that's that vulnerable. And that's part of where we also get our deepest moral value in life and where we find meaning is in the counting and being counted on. And so to me, like, that's not going to happen, right? You're not going to bond probably with the bacteria within you, but it's still a relationship. And right. And especially in those instances where we're seeing symbiosis, you are seeing, right, there is a mutuality there. And we can ask every time there's kind of those relationships, like, what are our obligations if this is a relationship we want to sustain?
Yeah, I love the way you explain that it's kind of, there's some positive things like nurturing the good biomes, but then kind of how do we best counteract the bad ones without making more super bugs for the future? Before I hand it back to Kirk for the final question, who do you think should be reading your article and what do you kind of want them to take, like, in a kind of nutshell?
So this is, like I mentioned, right? I think bioethics has sort of found its place in the clinic. In medicine, people have a sense sort of when to pick up the phone and call an ethicist. But a soil scientist, that's not occurring to them. It might not have occurred to them to pick up the phone and come and hang out with me and ask questions with me. And that's, I think, one of the really important things about this type of work is it's really trying to say, hey, bioethics really is a multidisciplinary practice. It actually needs every perspective. There is no discipline that doesn't belong in bioethics. So come on over, collaborate. Let's rethink what does a One Health team science approach even look like? And ethics should be there as a resource to people who are trying to ask these questions that are really complicated and have these other aspects that go alongside them. And maybe a clinician might also think of that, but I'm excited to bring more people into bioethics and in conversation and have them see us as sort of part of the natural picture when you're putting together a team and, or just, you know, want to exchange those ideas. We should open it up so that it's not just, right, the veterinary sciences or the basic scientists. Like, humanities deserve to be there at the table too, because maybe we have a way of talking or approaching a problem that can bridge. A lot of what bioethics does is bridge disciplines and come up with language, moral language often, that everyone can use as opposed to being stuck in those silos. So there is a new, like, North American One Health University network. That's kind of the example of an audience that's more on, right, the academic side that might be interested in this kind of piece. But I think it's really important for us to remember that there are a lot of, right, ethics is really about making sure that other people have a voice as well. And there are a lot of different advocacy questions that go alongside this, right? So there are people who maybe their family was affected by sepsis, which is an infection that didn't get detected on time. They needed antibiotics sooner than they got them. There might be people living with a resistant infection, and they know the challenges that the healthcare system might not be meeting, because that's not how they define the problem. The patients can see the problem. Maybe it's the communities, because they're the ones who are really in conversation with each other. And if you're really trying to solve these questions, you know, if you're trying to look for interventions that work collectively, those belong in public health, not in the clinic. And so there is also, I think, room here for us to have patients and communities and families at the table and being part of the conversation, so that it's not only experts that are defining the problem, which means they're defining the solutions.
Yeah, absolutely. And no, thank you for this, because usually we look, and we shouldn't, but in the sciences and medicine and healthcare, we unfortunately have such a linear approach to so many different things. And as we know, because human beings were not a monolith, right? There's so many multifaceted, multifactorial dynamics of being human and trying to stay healthy. We can't have the linear approach, right? We need to have the holistic approach, which you've mentioned throughout our conversation with you, and definitely appreciate your insight on that. It's extremely important, right? You just can't just have, it's like a puzzle. You have many pieces to the puzzle, and you can't just have two pieces and expect the puzzle to be done. You have to have multiple different pieces in order for that puzzle to be completed, and you have a complete holistic picture of what you're visually seeing. So you really help us and provided insight on that. So thank you very much on that. So my last question is about the future. So what future work would you like to see being done in which ethicists collaborate with others that builds on your ideas about One Health, right? I guess this holistic type of approach we just alluded to earlier.
Yeah, so I talked about how difficult it is to talk about those shared benefits, and maybe shared benefits is the right way to understand them, because everyone knows what sharing is and everyone knows what benefits is. So it's more intuitive. But there's this entire discourse called, like, public goods. It can have kind of an economic tinge to it. People talk about them as, like, sort of non-excludable, and it ends up being a lot about how markets work to satisfy individual preferences. But to me, I think that's why I want to get in the room with more patients and more providers. So yes, in the clinic, but also with public health workers who might be trying to reach entire communities. Sometimes what they're doing specifically in relationship to antimicrobial resistance is, like, you might walk into your primary care provider's office and you see, like, a sign that says, like, finish your antibiotics. Or if you have an ear infection, maybe don't take an antibiotic until you know it's a bacterial one. And that's super hard to communicate to a mom who has a screaming toddler. So I really get it. But there, right, there's that communication element there. And part of what you're trying to do is name a good, right? You're trying to name, what is this thing that we all want and that we share? And I do really think that that's something that we're really missing right now, is a way to talk about the things that benefit all of us and that we share and that we can only get if we all do things together. And it might be that, right, we have to farm that out to policy, right? We might say, like, okay, well, the only way to get this is if we have a policy that moves us towards that goal. But sometimes it also does require collective action, even just to advocate for that kind of policy change, right? So if you want you know, more holistic medicine, medicine that actually compensates providers for providing preventive care. That's something we can advocate for. But part of the movement toward that is being able to name the benefit. What is it that we all want? What's that common good? And I want to know what communities are naming it, because oftentimes you can't really make traction by using a technical specialized term that like a philosopher is going to come up with, or that, you know, an epidemiologist is going to come up with. And so I want to know how communities talk about the goods they share and how they understand that as something that they hold in common or hold together. That's the kind of language that I'm in search of right now.
No, excellent. And in the words of my colleague, brilliant, right? A communal approach to bioethics. We all need to hear each other out in our different perspectives to solve these massive problems, right, that we talked about. Well, Dr. Mahar, thank you so very much for such an insightful, enriching, and engaging conversation.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.